You all probably know Romans chapter 1, verse 20, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. So we can know something about the existence of God and even the nature of God by studying nature, by studying the created order. Do we need to cut off maybe some of these front lights and maybe be able to make sure you can see a little better? Hopefully you won't go to sleep, but I know I just ate some Boston Market, so I'm about ready to take a nap. But anyway, we know Romans 10:17 says that faith comes from hearing the Word of God, and we generally think of the Bible in particular about that because that's special revelation from God. But the created order is also a product of God's Word, and so there's a certain amount of faith we can get from that as well. You can't learn everything there is to know about God from nature, but you can definitely learn some things about God. Romans 1:20 tells you that, and it tells you you can come to even believe in God. So there's a certain amount of faith we can gain from that, and so I wanted to talk a little bit about that tonight. You probably know, in studying the created order over the centuries, humans have reasoned through and articulated many excellent philosophical arguments that all point to the conclusion that there has to be a God. And arguments which fight, though the atheists might, they still stand today as testaments to God's existence, and they have for hundreds of years. Blair Scott of American Atheists, he said, concerning the classical arguments for the existence of God, the theological arguments have not changed much over thousands of years. Now, he meant that as a jab at Kyle whenever he said that in his debate with Kyle, but he's actually right, and there's really nothing to be ashamed of about that. The classical arguments haven't changed much over the centuries because they haven't had to. The only changes have been really gathering more and more evidence that substantiate them to be truth. Truth doesn't need to change, so you shouldn't see them changing. In fact, the famous British cosmologist and evolutionist Fred Hoyle, he said that you should be suspicious of a theory if more and more hypotheses are needed to support it. Now, I think that's ironic because that perfectly describes evolutionary theories if you stay at all in up to date on what's going on in the naturalistic community. They're constantly having to update and revise their theories as they get some new scientific evidence. Well, the theological arguments don't have to be changed. All of the scientific evidence always supports the creation model. The classical arguments have stood the test of time and have never been disproven. They stand as testaments against atheism. Now, the teleological argument in particular is an argument that is of special interest to the scientist. And atheistic philosopher and professor Paul Ricci said, "It's true that everything designed has a designer." That statement basically summarizes what we call the teleological argument. If you can find the attribute of design in the universe, then there had to be, by implication, a designer. You never have design without a designer. And atheists like Ricci admit that basic truth. Now, granted, they generally refuse to admit that the universe has the element of design, but they concede that if there were the presence of design, then that would indicate there must be a designer. You can't have a poem without a poet. You can't have a painting without a painter. A fingerprint requires a finger, right? We know that. Now, typically in the first semester or so of engineering school, students are required to take an introductory course that helps them to understand engineering, what it is, what the differences are in various engineering fields, mechanical, electrical, chemical, civil. There's usually a section also on engineering ethics. But along with that intro, there's typically a lengthy discussion on the nature and process of design, since that is what engineers do, design. And so in these introductory classes, engineering students learn to appreciate how complex the design process really is. An effective design doesn't just happen. It's not something that you just throw together. And it's certainly not the result of a sequence of random events, like evolutionary theory suggests. It's not the result of an explosion in a messy room. There's an immense amount of planning and study and thought and intent and purpose that go into a good design. Common sense tells us when there is design present. It's not complicated to point out something that is complicated. And it's not complex trying to put your finger on something that has the attribute of complexity. And where there is planning and complexity and design, there must necessarily be a designer. We understand that idea. So the question tonight is, does the universe in fact contain this element of design? Well, in fact, there's an infinite number of examples from nature that clearly show intent and purpose and mind design. I'm a thermal scientist, so examples of thermal design in the universe are of special interest to me. So I want to take a few moments tonight and examine one of the amazing thermal systems that God created, the human biothermal system, which is the system that oversees how our bodies respond to temperature fluctuations. You ever thought about that much? Temperature changes in our environment and in our bodies, how our bodies respond to that. We've all been in situations where temperature significantly affected us, especially if you live down here in Florida, right? You usually aren't going to get too cold, maybe, but you've maybe been in that kind of situation, or you didn't wear a thick enough coat to a football game, and the temperature suddenly dropped without any warning. Maybe you woke up in the middle of the night and you needed another blanket. My wife's always needing another blanket, and I'd rather her just snuggle up because I don't want another blanket. Maybe you stayed out in the sun too long. You know about that. You got too hot and you forgot to wear a hat. Maybe you were silly enough to go out and mow the yard in the hottest part of the day. My dad always warned me not to do that. We got so hot maybe that we didn't feel right. Maybe we even got dizzy or fainted. Maybe we were at a theme park and we saw someone else faint or have a heat stroke walking around all day in the heat. We forgot to drink enough fluids. Maybe before we went out to work in the heat. So we got dehydrated from sweating. So what do we do? You ever think about that? You know, what do we do? Well, we basically do whatever we can to help fix the problem while we just wait to feel better. And then we just quickly move on with our lives and not really think about what's gone on. Have you ever stopped to think about what your body did to keep you from dying or to keep your tissues from being damaged? How your body responded and acclimated to extreme temperatures. How your hand and your body responds when you accidentally touch that hot stove. You ever thought about what's going on there? Or how your body adjusts to that hot bath when you ease into it and it quickly adjusts and all of a sudden it doesn't feel quite as hot anymore. Or whenever you jump into that cold pool, right? You can feel your body all of a sudden react and the temperature doesn't feel as extreme anymore. And we kind of take it for granted that that discomfort passes and that our bodies have really done something pretty amazing. They've automatically adjusted to that extreme temperature difference between our bodies and whatever it is that we touched. But you know, really, the human body's biothermal system, from an evolutionary perspective, this isn't something you can just dismiss without thought. It is proof positive of design and intent and purpose, and therefore, by implication, a designer, God. Thermoregulation is the term that is used to describe an organism's ability to regulate its body temperature. So to keep its body temperature within certain levels despite its surrounding environment. So it's the equivalent of like an air conditioning system in your body or a heating system, but it's for living creatures. 91.8 degrees to about 100.8 degrees Fahrenheit is the range that describes the normal human body temperature if that measurement is taken orally. Now, what is considered normal is based on where you take that measurement on the body, the level of activity of the person that's being, even gender plays a role on that. So it's not a hard and fast single number, although many people will use that average number of 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. The amazing thing is that your body is equipped with such an amazing system, temperature system, that the vast majority of the time, even right now, you don't have to even think about your body temperature. You can just go about your day-to-day life and you can work extremely hard and be extremely active, or you can just lay around like a couch potato watching TV and your body, your body's thermal system just regulates that temperature for you. It'll just keep that temperature within a safe range for you without you having to think about it. You don't have to give it a second thought. Now, your body does this through the use of an extremely complex system, again, called this thermoregulatory system, the system that helps to regulate your body temperature. Now, the entire thermoregulatory system, the entire temperature system, is controlled, as you might guess, by the brain. The processing center in the brain that controls the biothermal system is the hypothalamus, which is basically the thermostat for your body's air conditioning system. So it controls the thermoregulatory system. The body uses temperature sensors like thermometers or thermocouples, if you're an engineer. These are called thermoreceptors in your body. And these sensors are located throughout the human body, and they read the temperature wherever they are. These sensors, they take the temperature. And these thermoreceptors are in the hypothalamus, they're in your skin, they're in your bladder, they're even in your eyes. And the thermoreceptors that are in your skin are the peripheral nerves, and they can detect changes in external temperature, so temperature changes in the air. And the thermoreceptors in the hypothalamus detect changes in blood temperature. And from that temperature information, the hypothalamus is able to adjust different kinds of functions using effector nerves. These are kind of like power lines that are used to communicate between your brain and various parts of the body to initiate various kinds of thermal responses, which then in turn affects heat loss in your body. Very sophisticated system, clearly shows design and intent, not random accidents. Now, the amazing thing is that the way that the hypothalamus controls your body's temperature is the equivalent of what is called a fuzzy logic controller in engineering. Now, what in the world is that? You use controllers in your car, right? When you use cruise control, for example, or your air conditioning system in your house, when you keep your temperature, try to keep your temperature below a certain number. These are controllers, but they're not the same as a fuzzy logic controller. These controllers are called different things, bang-bang controllers, on-off controllers. But the hypothalamus operates more like this more sophisticated controller called a fuzzy logic controller, much more efficient than the control systems that are used in like your vehicle or in the AC in your house. Now, here's how it works. In an air conditioning unit in your house, when the temperature in the house gets too high, so in other words, it gets above the number that you've set for the system, then that AC just turns on, right? It just turns on full steam until the temperature in the house drops back down to the number that you set. So the AC unit only has the option of being all the way on or all the way off. There's no middle ground. When that AC turns on, then the motor's on full power, and the system is putting out the coldest air that it has to offer until the house drops back down to that desired temperature, and then it just abruptly cuts off. So the temperature in the house or the state of that motor tends to have more of this jagged-like profile like this on the screen, very abrupt, sharp, up and down, tooth-like. So the temperature is a lot less regulated. It doesn't stay as close to the temperature that you really want. Now, it's not good. It wouldn't be good if your body was uncontrolled like that. A fuzzy controller like the hypothalamus allows for degrees of on and off, different levels. With a fuzzy controller, the AC could be on, but the motor not be on full speed. So it's not blowing out as high or not putting out air that's quite as cold, if that's what's needed. You know, that's kind of the equivalent of what we're talking about. So a fuzzy controller keeps that temperature profile more regulated and smooth and closer to the desirable temperature. It doesn't have that jagged-like effect. And that's important because if your body starts to get too far away from the desired temperature, then you'll be in danger. And we'll discuss that more later. Now, amazingly, the hypothalamus uses sophisticated temperature control like that. If your body gets too hot, then the hypothalamus doesn't just turn the temperature control system on full power. It varies its response based on the temperature. It'll produce more sweat or swell blood vessels more if you're extremely hot than it would if you were just a little bit warm. And if you're extremely cold, the opposite will happen, and different levels of shivering will be induced. We'll talk about that in a moment. So the hypothalamus actually allows for different levels of response to temperature changes, like a fuzzy logic control system. Now, in engineering, we design controllers. Fuzzy logic controllers, like the hypothalamus, by definition, are designed. They require intent and purpose. If there is a control system, there must be an engineer that designed it. That's what all the evidence says. You never see a control system ever. You've never observed a control system that was not designed. The hypothalamus is a control system, and it is the most sophisticated control system that you've ever seen. It requires an engineer to have designed it. How in the world could the hypothalamus, equipped with such complex engineering elements, just randomly evolve on accident? The hypothalamus, the thermostat for the human body's temperature system, is decisive evidence of intent, purpose, and design. Another feature of the biothermal system, did you know that shivering is an important, intentional part of your temperature system? As you get colder, your hypothalamus sends the message to your muscles to start shaking or shivering. And that increased use of muscles leads to an increase in metabolism, so more calorie burning and more heat production. It also makes more friction and heat production from the muscles contacting those surrounding tissues. So those tissues surrounding those shivering muscles are warmed up. So again, does that sound like a feature that just would happen on accident or something that was worked into the human body's temperature system? Then there's vasodilation and vasoconstriction. In my opinion, one of the most fascinating features of the temperature system. And the temperature sensors in your skin, remember those are the thermoreceptors, when they tell the hypothalamus that, hey, the temperature is getting too hot, then the hypothalamus sends a message back to those blood vessels that are close to the skin, and the message tells those blood vessels to swell, to dilate. And that swelling allows warm blood to flow to those areas that are closest to the skin, which is why you sometimes look reddish or flushed when you get hot. Then while all that warm blood is closer to the surface, more body heat can be released into the air from that warm blood. Or when you're cold, the hypothalamus does the opposite. It tells the vessels to contract, which keeps that warm blood further away from the exterior parts of your body, so that body heat isn't released as easily. At the same time, the warm blood is then pulled in to these vital organs in order to keep them warm. So if the temperature stays too low too long, then those vital organs are given preference over the outer organs that you can technically live without. Now again, does that sound like a mind thought through that to you? The safety of the fingers and the hands and the toes and the feet and the tips of your nose, your ears, those are sacrificed due to this in order to have safety for your vital organs. Now, how in the world could a feature like that randomly and accidentally evolve? Blood vessel contraction and dilation, again, shows planning and intent and purpose. It shows a mind. Then there's blood viscosity. When we get cold, blood actually becomes thicker, more viscous. God designed blood with that capability and put it in our bodies, and it actually becomes thicker, more viscous. And so the blood flow rate will tend to decrease, and that results in less heat loss through the veins. When you get hot, the blood becomes thinner, less viscous, and the blood flow rate will tend to increase, according to an engineering equation called Poiseuille's equation. Bottom line, vasodilation, vasoconstriction, thermal control of blood viscosity, all design features, again, of this thermoregulatory system. And then there's body fat, which serves as insulation, helping the heat to stay inside our bodies. Now, the interesting thing is, during the winter months when it's colder, we tend to gain body fat. We gain more insulation. Now, that may tend to make us feel kind of bad, and that's kind of inconvenient in this day and age, but think about areas of the world where people don't have the luxury of heating systems and lots of extra blankets and clothes. Well, that tendency to gain fat in the winter is pretty handy. Now, why do we gain fat? Well, for one, we tend to be less active in the winter than in the summer, but also physiologically, we know that there's a brain chemical, serotonin, that affects mood and appetite. And scientists have discovered that serotonin is at its lowest levels in your brain during the winter and on dark, cooler days. On sunny days, serotonin tends to be higher. So in order to boost that serotonin on colder days, guess what your body does? It makes it where you have a craving for sugary, starchy foods. Okay, well, those foods help to boost serotonin by increasing insulin, which pushes tryptophan up into your brain, which in turn initiates the building of this serotonin. The serotonin boost in the hypothalamus enhances the thermoregulatory system, especially in response to these cold temperatures. And then at the same time, you gain fat from the carbs, which helps to insulate your bodies from the cold. Another characteristic of body fat that shows purpose and design for the temperature system. Scientists know that statistically, women tend to have more body fat than men. On average, men tend to have about 17% body fat. Women are fatties. They have 6% more. That's just the science of it. Why in the world do women have more fat? Well, it's partially due to physiological reasons, the female anatomy. But one big reason is for protection, I would argue. Women are statistically, and in keeping with 1 Peter 3:7, smaller and weaker than men, and therefore in need of more physical protection. Fat helps to provide a cushioning barrier that protects vital organs if a woman is struck or falls. But from a thermal point of view, That extra fat in women will help to provide them with more heat insulation for heat retention, since women, on average, historically, tend to be naturally less physically active and therefore less heat generation from muscle movement. Now, of course, perhaps the most obvious benefit of more fat for women is for protection for babies during pregnancy. I can hear all the women kind of like, you're going to tell your husbands off later or something. Mommy fat, of course, helps to provide protection for babies and helps keep the baby warm. So baby fat, body fat encouraged by serotonin levels and gender physiology, another amazing design feature of the thermoregulatory system. And then there's more. There's the body's composition. Our bodies are made up of about 50 to 70% water by weight. It's different based on your gender and other things. 60% is a good average. Now that has an important thermal implication. Water has a special property which makes it handy in keeping temperatures regulated from getting too extreme. In thermal science terms, it has what is called a high specific heat capacity. Now what that means is that water can hold a lot of heat, way more than almost any other natural substance on the earth. It can store a lot of heat or lose a lot of heat without its temperature being drastically changed. So it acts like an air conditioning unit for our body and helps to keep our temperature relatively constant. It takes more heat or more cold to drastically change your body temperature since it has so much water in it, because water will tend to keep your body temperature regulated and close to our body's core temperature. Now, another interesting fact about the percentage of water in our bodies is that our body weight can go up several pounds due to water retention in the summer. You ever notice that? Our bodies go through a process called heat acclimatization as we enter into those summer months, and we retain more water in order to regulate temperature and prepare for higher levels of sweat loss. Now think about this. What if your bodies didn't have as much water? Or what if they had another fluid instead of water, making up 60% of our bodies? Well, if that were the case, then the body's temperature system would not work nearly as effectively. It'd be more susceptible to fluctuation due to environmental temperature changes. So from an engineering design standpoint, using water and lots of it in the design of the human body was an excellent choice. And you would expect that, again, if an engineer, a mind is behind this whole design that we have. Again, this shows design, planning, intent, purpose. Then there's the bladder, specifically the bladder's detrusor muscle. There are thermoreceptors in the bladder taking temperature, and they send that temperature data up to the hypothalamus. And as the temperature of the bladder drops due to the cold, then a bladder cooling reflex is triggered in the hypothalamus, and the message is sent back down to the detrusor muscle on the bladder, telling it to contract. And that detrusor contraction makes you feel the urge to go expel that cold water, right? And eliminate that from your body, thus keeping your body's temperature regulated. Now again, keep in mind, how in the world would a system like that just accidentally happen? Doesn't it seem more reasonable that that was an engineering design choice to do that? That that's something that has a mind behind it? You would have to believe in the idea of evolution and naturalism so much to just ignore reason in order to think that something like that could accidentally happen. When you look at this without bias, it's clear, it's common sense, it's logical, this is design. Now, the thermoregulatory system has essentially two departments, what I call an interior and an exterior department. If we move into the exterior department, you have the skin. And on the skin, we have a lot of hair. Many scientists, many evolutionists consider a hair to be a vestigial organ. So evolutionists believe that hair was a leftover organ from our ape-like ancestors. They needed all that hair. We don't really need it now, and it's just kind of left over. And it just hadn't been eliminated from our physiology yet. But guess what? We're discovering more and more functions for this hair that's showing us, well, actually, there are some functions for this, many functions, including the fact that hair is an alarm system. Isn't that kind of important? It's like a tripwire that alerts us to things that may be on our skin, potentially dangerous things. It also serves, we're discovering, as a lubricant. It lessens the friction between your skin and areas where the skin tends to rub together a lot, like in your armpit regions, for example. It serves as a filter, like in your nose and in your ears. helping to keep harmful elements out of your body. Your eyebrows and your eyelashes give protection to your eyes, keeping fallen particles out. They also serve aesthetical purposes, adding beauty to the human head, especially around the eyes. Now, besides all of these important functions for hair, it of course also has thermal functions that are important for the thermoregulatory system. Your eyebrows and eyelashes serve as barriers to sweat droplets, helping to protect your vision when you get hot. Hair provides protection from thermal radiation. Eyelashes provide shading for the eyes from harmful sun rays. And the hair on your scalp and face and arms and legs, of course, helps to provide shading to prevent sunburn and skin cancer. Hair acts as a thermal insulator for your arms, your legs, your armpits, your scalps, your undersides, your face. It helps your body to retain heat by providing this extra layer of fabric on the skin. Now, interestingly, have you ever noticed where hair tends to be localized on the human body? Heat rises. So it's interesting to note that the body seems to have been, again, designed to have more hair, more insulation in those areas of the body where heat would tend to rise to and there be released to your surroundings. So the head, the armpits, your under regions, more hair in those areas would tend to help insulate the body in those areas and help to retain some of that heat that would tend to be lost from those areas. And then there's piloerection, which is a scientist's fancy way of saying goosebumps. I think this is another amazing feature of the thermoregulatory system. The thermoreceptors in the skin are constantly reading the temperature of the air and sending that info back to the hypothalamus in the brain. And when the temperature readings from some of those thermoreceptors get low enough, then the hypothalamus makes the decision to send a message back to those areas where that cold temperature was detected by those thermoreceptors. Now, muscles are attached to the base of every hair follicle. And the hypothalamus's message tells those muscles to contract. Now that contraction generates a little bit of interior heat, which helps with warmth, but more importantly, it raises those hairs. Why in the world would it do that? Those raised hairs catch heat that are released by the body and creates a thermal mat, a heat pillow between the cold air and your skin. And the opposite happens when you get hot. Those hairs are lowered. Now, what's more, have you ever noticed that goosebumps are localized? They only pop up where they're needed. The hypothalamus doesn't just send a generic message to all the hairs in your body to just stand up like a goosebump on or off switch. Yeah, the hypothalamus is able to pinpoint the localized areas where the temperature is cold and only raise those hairs that need to be raised. Now, again, think about this. Is that something that would just happen? Or does that sound like some engineer was behind that? It's logic. It's common sense. And then there's the skin pore size, which plays a role in this. When the surrounding temperature drops and your hypothalamus gives the command to generate goosebumps, then those skin pores for each hair decrease at the same time. So the pore sizes are smaller, thus allowing for less heat through those holes to be released. Now again, how in the world could something like that evolve by random chance? Piloerection shouts out design. What about the fact that men tend to have more hair than women? So women are fatties, men are hairy, right? This is, I believe, another interesting design feature of the human biothermal system. Did you know that men, on average, have 8 to 10 times more testosterone than women? And that plays out in a lot of different ways. But according to the American Association for Clinical Chemistry, the amount of hair that a person has been shown to be proportional to testosterone levels. So men tend to have more hair than women. And now it's handy for different reasons, but from a thermal perspective, it's handy because men tend to be larger than women and be involved in more physical activity. Therefore, we sweat more. Now, how in the world is that helpful? Well, incidentally, one of the beneficial functions of hair is that it tends to catch and hold sweat drops, keeping them on the skin, which helps to cool the skin more effectively. More on that in a moment. So men sweat more and therefore seem to have been created with more hair to help with the sweat cooling process. So another amazing feature of the human body, which helps to regulate temperature, clearly designed with specific purposes in mind, not a product of evolution. What about sweat? Now, as I've said, there's these temperature receptors taking the temperature throughout your body, kind of like these heat sensors, and they send that information to the hypothalamus, right? And it kicks in and starts telling the thermal system to compensate for temperature change. And some of those elements that the hypothalamus controls for temperature adjustment are these sweat glands. If the body gets too hot from the outside temperature or from lots of activity, the hypothalamus senses an increase in your body's core temperature, and it reacts by increasing blood flow to the skin, which in turn stimulates these sweat glands. So in essence, the hypothalamus tells the sweat glands to start secreting more sweat onto the surface of your skin. Now, why would it do that? Remember, I mentioned that water has this characteristic of retaining high amounts of heat, right? So as your body's temperature rises and all that water is gradually getting hotter, well, your hypothalamus makes the decision, we got to get that hot water out of here and get it onto the surface of your skin, where some of that heat can quickly be lost through evaporation and radiation and convection as it comes into contact with moving air. That in turn leaves cooler water on your skin. Now, one of the rules of thermodynamics, known as the Clausius statement of the second law, is that heat always moves from higher temperature areas to lower temperature places. So the cooler water, the sweat, that's on your skin causes heat from your skin, which is hotter, to be pulled into those sweat droplets. When that heat is where that, then it can be released into that surrounding air. Now, how in the world, again, could a process with such clear design and intent be deemed an accident? Again, it seems to me a person would have to be just biased against the idea of a designer just bent on rejecting logic in order to hold to such an irrational view for some hidden reason. Another type of exterior thermal regulation comes from behavioral instincts. What do? When you get cold? Well, you do some things instinctively. You pull your arms in. Maybe you put your head down. You curl up. We instinctively can do things that will conserve body heat. Well, we know from science that these types of behaviors will help to keep you warm. But why is it instinctive that you do these things? It's like there was a pre-program designed into the body, again, indicating design. Another amazing feature of the thermoregulatory system, you ever noticed how your eyes tend to water when you get cold, maybe from a gust of cold wind? Well, scientists have discovered that there's these thermal receptors in the eye, even in the cornea. And as the cornea thermal receptors read the temperature of your eyes and indicate to the hypothalamus, hey, we're getting cold down here, then the hypothalamus tells the tear ducts to generate tears, hot fluids from within your body. And those warm tears help to keep your eyes from freezing and blinding you. So we can add tear generation now to the list of these temperature devices that the body has. Doing all of this simultaneously, it all builds up to make this complex system, you see. Without a designer for this, this whole feature would be inexplicable. Now, we could keep going on and on about this. I've really only touched the hem of the garment. We haven't even looked, for example, at how your system responds to thermal damage, like burns and sunburn and blisters, or how thermal therapy can be used to heal the body. But let's think through some of the implications of what we looked at. There's no way that these features could be the result of random processes. Again, they showed intent and purpose and design. But beyond that, consider this, If your body were not able to regulate your temperature with the amazing degree of accuracy that it does, then the result would be catastrophic. If your temperature deviates 2 degrees from its normal temperature, then your health is in serious danger. And if your temperature deviates just 5 degrees from normal, then the consequences could be deadly. Now think about that. 5 degrees, that's not much. That means the human's biothermal system has to be extremely effective in quickly responding to temperature fluctuations before the temperature gets too far from your core temperature. And its mechanisms have to be very effective in warding off heat and cold. The thermoregulatory system has to be extremely well designed to keep us alive. Hyperthermia results if your temperature is too high. Hypothermia occurs when your body is producing or absorbing more heat than it can handle, that it can regulate. Usually happens at temperatures above 101 degrees Fahrenheit. If your temperature climbs above 104, then it'll be life-threatening. Brain damage will likely occur. Hypothermia results if your temperature is too low, somewhere around 95 degrees. And these conditions, as you know, can be deadly. If your body temperature moves into these deadly ranges and it stays there for more than just a few minutes, then severe damage and or death will occur. So your system is constantly at work trying to prevent these dangerous conditions from happening. But now think about it. If evolution were true, then wouldn't hypothermia and hyperthermia have quickly killed off human beings and their ancestors long before those bodies could have evolved these extremely complex biothermal system components, which keeps our temperature so precisely regulated. If our thermoregulatory system were not intact at this moment, every one of us would quickly die. What's the surrounding temperature in here? You know, maybe 72, right? Something like that. Your temperature is around 98.6. So without your regulatory system, what's going to happen? It's going to move to that 72. You will die if it does that. If your temperature got down to 72, you're a corpse. So how could macroevolution evolve the entire biothermal system in the time span required to keep us alive? How could random chance produce such a complex system at all? A system which shows such purpose and intent and design, much less do it in the time span required to keep life alive. I think this is common sense. How could the temperature sensors of the body, the thermal receptors located throughout the body in strategic places, how could just those have evolved quickly enough? How could the communication lines between those thermal receptors and the hypothalamus, the effector nerves, how could they evolve and evolve in time to prevent death? How could the hypothalamus evolve the thermostat capabilities that it has to take temperature readings from those thermal receptors and respond by sending messages along these specific design pathways to the muscles and the sweat glands and your eyes and your bladder, producing tears on the eyes to protect them? How could evolution account for temperature sensors in the bladder at all, much less their ability to determine what the temperature is? How could evolution account for the power line of communication between the bladder and the hypothalamus? You know, think about it. A partially formed effector nerve would be pointless. If it's not fully connecting the two, it would be totally functionless. The effector nerve had to be completely formed and installed from the beginning, from the creation of it. How could evolution cause the temperature systems, sensors, to read a temperature and then know, just accidentally, oh, okay, we need to send this information along these power lines, and then the hypothalamus gets that information and goes, oh, I wonder what I'm supposed to do with this. And all of a sudden, it just knows what to do, whether or not it needs to send a message back to the bladder, specifically. Unless you're just bent on rejecting God, that is obvious. When the more you, as a scientist, dig into this stuff, the more you see how clear this is. But design requires planning, and planning requires intent. Intent requires thinking. Thinking requires a mind, period. Evolutionary theory, all other atheistic explanations for the origin of the universe, they do not have a mind. Evolutionary theory is based on randomness and chaos and accident. God, the supermind behind the universe, the chief engineer, clearly created the human body. Psalm 139:14, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. Thank you for your attention.